you very much. And thank you for coming in the lunchtime slot. I really appreciate that. I'm going to try and keep you as entertained as possible. I'm going to talk to you about the people that Jesus chose above all others to call the children of God, the peacemakers. I'm going to give you some bad news, but I'm going to give you more good news. And the best news I can give you is that there's something that everyone can do to support these peacemakers. I'm planning to talk for about 20 minutes, then I'm going to ask you to get up and do something, and then I'll talk for a bit more, and then we'll have questions and answers. So that's just to give you a sort of roadmap. And I'm going to move from the sort of macro political level to the grassroots and back up and then back down to show you how the two dimensions are very connected. So I'll start with some context. There's an organization called SIPRI, the Stockholm Institute for Peace Research, and they publish a yearbook every year, and the yearbook tells us about conflict in the world at the moment. In the 2004 yearbook, all the 19 conflicts where more than 1,000 people were killed were within countries, not between countries. And I'm guessing that that may be a world first. That may be the first year where all the conflicts that were raging within countries. And that has a lot of implications, which will come out all the way through what I'm going to say to you. Another interesting statistic, of those 19 conflicts, only three were less than 10 years old. 16 of the 19 conflicts have been going on for more than 10 years. And that's also very relevant to what I'm going to talk about. So on the plus side, we've got the number of conflicts declining. We've got the fact that large areas of the world have grown out of war, which means that it may be more possible to think of making war history than making poverty history. But on the minus side, increasingly the victims of conflict are civilians, and that's true whether we're talking about bombing in Iraq or whether we're talking about kidnapping and abduction in countries like the DRC, the Democratic Republic of Congo, and Uganda. And the other piece of bad news, which you can watch ticking by minute in the peace zone, is the growth in military spending. So in this situation, what's the role of the local peacemakers? Well, I'm with Albert Einstein. Albert Einstein said, "Peace cannot be kept by force. It can only be achieved through understanding." Can you hear me? Right. And I'm going to tell you some stories of very different kinds of people who have tried to develop that understanding that leads to peace. Incidentally, this is why we've got a symbol, we've got a standard, a flip chart at our stand, trying to encourage people to think of new symbols for peace. Because the work that I'm going to talk about is very arduous. It's blood, sweat, and tears. It's people risking their lives. It's not people sitting around saying, "Peace and love, man." And so we are trying to find symbols that really express that. So if you're the least bit artistic, do come along and do a drawing. And if you're not artistic but you've got good ideas, we've got a fantastic artist on our stand who'll turn your ideas into something that looks really amazing. So that's just about active peace building. Let me start with a story about a judge. This was from the Christian Science Monitor, and I think it's absolutely fascinating. I'm going to read it out. It happened in the Yemen. It says, "When Judge Hamoud al-Hittar announced that he and four other Islamic scholars would challenge Yemen's al-Qaeda prisoners to a theological contest, Western anti-terrorist experts warned that this high-stakes gamble would end in disaster. Nervous as he faced five captured yet defiant al-Qaeda members in a prison, the judge was inclined to agree. But banishing his doubts, he threw down the gauntlet in the hope of bringing peace to his troubled homeland. 'If you can convince us that your ideas are justified by the Quran, then we will join you in the struggle,' he said. 'If we succeed in convincing you of our ideas, then you must agree to renounce violence.' And the prisoners agreed. 2 years later, not just those prisoners have been released, but there's peace in Yemen. And the same people who doubted his capacity to engage in these theological dialogues are now coming to learn from him. Since December 2002, when the first round of dialogues ended, there have been no terrorist attacks here, even though many people thought that Yemen would become a capital of terror. 364 young men have been released after going through the dialogues, and none of them have left Yemen to fight anywhere else. And that's an example of one person using both imagination and courage to engage in dialogue rather than just locking people up and hoping for the best. The second person I want to talk about is actually someone that Peace Direct has been supporting. He's a very different kind of person. He's a British Iraqi who came to hear a talk given by Sylla Elworthy, the founder of Peace Direct. And at the end of it, he said, "I want to do something. What can I do?" And he decided to go back to his hometown of Kirkuk in northern Iraq and to set up a centre for listening and dialogue, the Humanitarian Liaison Centre. And what he does in the centre is people come and tell their stories of how they've been damaged by the conflict. And he and his interviewers record the details and help people to get redress. And in this way, he is hoping that they won't feel that they have to pick up a gun and take things into their own hands. This has turned out to be a really important project because what he's doing is holding to account both the occupying powers and increasingly now the Iraqi National Guard, so that they don't feel that they can just burst into people's houses and take stuff away and imprison people and not tell their relatives where they are. There is a place where relatives can go, and Sami has regular meetings with the US commander to say, come on, you know, you've taken someone away, where is he? What he tells me about conditions in Kirkuk is quite shocking and depressing, but I know that because he's there, people are less likely to be turning to violence and more likely to be getting a good outcome. Now let's turn things to the other side. There's a story which I really love about a militia commander. Afghanistan's one of the countries where conflict has been going on for the longest. And there's an organization called the Coalition for Peace and Unity, CAPAU, which, again, we've supported in a small way. And what CAPAU does is they build peace committees at village level and at district level where they bring together the police, the militias, women, businessmen, school teachers, religious leaders. And everyone works together to try to create norms for peaceful conduct, peaceful resolution of conflict. So they were holding a five-day training session, and the local militia commander, because it was in his territory, he felt it was only polite to come along. So he came along intending to stay for a couple of hours, and he stayed for the first day, and then he stayed for the next day, and actually he stayed for the whole week, which he hadn't at all intended to do. And one of the stories that they told was a story about a militia commander in Colombia who had decided to give up violence. And at the end of the week, this militia commander in Afghanistan said, "I don't apologize for the fact that I fought against the Russians because they were invading our country and they had to be stopped. But I feel deeply sorry that I fought against my own people, and I'm now going to disband my militia and I'm going to become a commander for peace." And I think that's an example of how, in the right setting and with a role model, people can change profoundly. The last story I want to tell is one that's actually in here. It's the story of Ben Mazanzi Wamazungu, who's a very ardent Christian in the Democratic Republic of Congo. He was captured, actually, by members of his own tribe who mistook him for someone else. And he was convinced that he was going to be executed. And at the moment where his fear was greatest, he fell down into a trance. And this so unnerved the people who were trying to kill him that they just stood back. And when he woke out of the trance, he told them who he was. And they didn't kill him. But at that point, he realized that God was calling him to make peace. And what he writes in here is really interesting and moving. That was in 1993, and he got a group of people together to form the Centre Résolution Conflit. And they started in 1997 in a place called Nyakunde. Nyakunde was actually the most beautiful place in the world. It's when we hear about Africa, we always hear about famine and we think of it as a place of violence. But I was really startled to hear one of Mazanzi's colleagues on the radio saying Nyakunde was the most beautiful place and you could have everything there that your heart desired. But when the conflict came, the center was destroyed and the deputy director and all his family were killed. But they didn't give up. They took the center and they moved it to another place, Benia. And then that was again ransacked. And they decided that they wouldn't give up. And now they're in Beni. And we've just visited them there. And what they're doing is they're working with people who are internally displaced in the Congo, trying to build trust and dialogue so that when they go back to their own villages, they can actually live peacefully with people of other tribes and they don't feel the distrust that they used to feel. And so they're doing things like they're holding workshops to explain where did the conflict come from and who's really interested in prolonging it so that people don't just think that conflict is inevitable. They realize that it's being fueled by external forces and that they can fight against it. When we put the focus on people like this, I think it turns the whole vision of what peace is upside down, rather in the way that, you know, throughout the Gospels, Jesus is always saying, they say this, but I say that. They say that conflicts are resolved by the UN, by, you know, international mediation. We need the Norwegians to come in and do what the Norwegians do so fantastically well, and that the peace will then be made between usually the perpetrators. So in Aceh, the peace agreement's just been signed by the government and by GAM, both of whom have been using violence. What we say is, yes, but peace is maintained by the action of local people, people at the grassroots. And it's only through those actions of local people that you get a lasting peace where people's attitudes towards the other are changed. So, does it work? Well, I'm going to tell you a rather longer story which explains how it did work in one particular situation. I'm not saying that there's a formula. That would be ridiculous. All of these people are struggling in their work against external forces that are very strong. But what you can say is that every step that they take to create a local organization, a local civil society organization of people working together to challenge violence and challenge authority makes the country a stronger place for the eventual day when the violence will end and a democratically accountable government comes into being. So I'm going to tell you a story about Kenya, which some of you may know. And it starts in the marketplace in the Wajir province in 1993. What happened was that people noticed that gradually the women in the marketplace were stopping selling to anyone except their own clan. So gradually they were withdrawing into their own clan, and that was as a result of growing tension and conflict over water resources, particularly between camel herders and pastoralists. So one of the women decided to do something about this. And interestingly, going back to the idea of people being inspired by other people's experience, and rather bizarrely, the thing that inspired Dekker was a story of Dutch people in the war sheltering Jews. And I found that so interesting, you know, that she'd looked back 50 years or so to a story in a completely different continent. So she had been inspired by this story to feel that actually people didn't have to just sit and accept what was happening. They could do something about it. So she went around and she started talking to women from other clans in the market, and she got a small group of women together. And they made the most extraordinary pledge, and her story is in this book, which you can buy at the bookstand. The pledge that they asked people to make was, if a member of my family is killed by a member of your family, you must promise that you'll still work with us. And if you can't make that promise, then please don't join the group. And I always find that such an amazing statement, really, to have made that right at the beginning of the process. So the women started to create dialogue between the different clans at the level of women. Meanwhile, the conflict was growing, and in the end, 1,500 people were killed while this Wajir process was getting off the ground. they realized that they weren't going to be really successful unless they got the clan elders on board, because that was where the traditional authority lay. So they kind of mobilized themselves behind the clan elders. They put the clan elders in the forefront, and they were encouraging them to go back to and rediscover ways of resolving conflict that were traditional to Wajir, but which had been forgotten. And so over a period of about 4 years, they built, rather like the Afghanistan example, they built all the different groups in society into this network of the Wajir Peace and Development Project. And at each level, people were working and doing the things that were appropriate to do at that level. And eventually they brought an end to the violence. Now, fast forward to 2004, we got a call from Decca, who's one of our patrons, saying, I'm really worried about what's happening in Mandera, which is the next door province. Would you be able to find me £5,000 so that some of us can go from Wajir up to Mandera, where the same kind of conflict had already killed about 60 people and displaced thousands of people? Could you fund us to go up there and teach them everything that we've learned over the last 11 years so that we can bring an end to the conflict there? So fortunately, we were able to lay hands on some money. And she actually managed to raise $4,500 from Kenyan businesses, which was really impressive. And so they went up to Mandera and they started talking, you know, police talking to police, women talking to women, clan elders talking to clan elders. And within about a month, they'd had a big conference and brought everyone together and helped them to rediscover, again, the old ways of resolving conflict. It's really interesting in Mandera because there are these three opportunities to resolve conflict. You can go out and kill a lot of the other people's people, which is, you know, what they had been doing. You can use the government system of justice, which is very slow, or you can go back to traditional methods of justice and reconciliation, whereby people agree that, you know, if someone has been killed, that's worth 28 camels, but it's not worth someone else being killed from another clan. Now the work in Mandera needs long-term funding, so we're just opening up one of our projects to provide that long-term funding in Mandera. But it also kind of sparked an idea in my mind, which was obviously what's needed is rapid response funding as well. So people need long-term funding so that their work can be embedded and can grow. Because what very often happens with these local peace builders, because they're such effective people, they get recruited by the development agencies. So they do great development work, but the peace work gets abandoned. And that's obviously very unproductive, because relationships take years to be built up and you want continuity. So the long-term funding, which we do through the Champions Programme, is very important. But rapid response funding is also really important. So what we're going to experiment with DECA, is a fund that will be based in Kenya, will be controlled by local people, but which we will fundraise for. So that if there is the beginning of violence, and you may have read about the awful incident where 80 people were killed, a lot of them were school children in northern Kenya a couple of months ago. If violence starts to break out, there's the money to do something really quickly, because it's just so obvious that it's much easier to stop something when it's small than when it's been spreading like wildfire. And yet all the sources of funding at the moment are so long-term that by the time they've come through, if they even come through at all, the violence has got out of hand. So I think that's enough of me for the time being. What I wanted to ask you to do is find someone who you don't know, preferably. Maybe stand up to sort of get some blood circulating. And just spend about 10 minutes talking to each other about someone you know who's a peacemaker, and what are the qualities that make that person a good peacemaker. So I'll give you a very small example to start with. My younger daughter is the person that all her friends go to sort out their problems. In fact, they call her Jerry Springer. And I was sort of thinking, why is that? And I think it's because in her case, because she's got a really good understanding of human psychology, much better than I'll ever have. And because she's very kind of self-effacing, so she doesn't put herself in the picture, but she listens to them and brings them together. So can I ask you to stand up? Come on. Find someone who looks nice and who you'd like to have a 10-minute conversation with. And then at the end, I'll just ask for a few contributions. What you've found out about what makes a good peacemaker. Maybe someone who wants to hear their voice on the tape that's going to be produced of this. Okay, well then I'll pick up the threads. So I hope from that you've sort of got a good understanding of the sort of work that we're supporting at Peace Direct, the sort of work that thousands of people, literally thousands of groups, are doing worldwide, which we never hear about. When conflict is reported, it's reported in terms of perpetrators and victims. So we hear about the evil Janjaweed, and we hear about the African farmers who they're persecuting. But we don't hear about the Sudanese church groups who are actually working to try and build peace. That's one of the things that Peace Direct is trying to change. I just want to talk a bit about how do the things that we do in this country affect this work? Because it's not just over there, it's about here as well. The first thing is resources. Central to what we're trying to do is to better resource this peace work. The UK government spends about 1% of the military budget on peace building and peacekeeping, which is a real shame because actually the British Army are really good at this stuff and they could do a lot more if they were allowed to. So we need to change that balance. We need to try and imagine what a world would be like if there were academies for peace on the same scale as military academies, if there were standing peacekeeping forces that could move in to situations that needed it at the first sign of violence. The world could be very different if we tipped that balance. And one of the things that we're doing, in fact, is working with the US and UK military training establishments on a case study of how Fallujah could have been handled very differently if it had been handled using non-violent approaches. So as a peace activist from Burundi said, I thought this was really lovely. He said, people recognize that it costs money to wage war. Somehow they don't recognize it costs money to wage peace. And that's the sort of light bulb moment we need to try and create. The second thing is governance. I've been accused of being a Pollyanna. I really don't think I am. I think it would be very Pollyanna-ish to think that all the worst human instincts of greed and aggression will disappear just like that. So the point of good governance and the activities that a lot of these peace activists are engaged on are about holding people to account so that their worst instincts aren't allowed to come to the fore. The point is to control these instincts so that when behavior is abusive, it's noted and punished. And ultimately, this has to be done by people within the country, and often they pay a very high price. The sort of things that Western corporations and governments do that undermine this are when they give bribes to local politicians, and we're not just talking about the arms trade. You can look at some extraordinary projects over the years and think those must have been the result of bribes because nobody could have made a rational decision to take them. When we attach conditions to aid, like the requirement to charge school fees, which are not in the interest of local people, because what that does is it encourages the government of the country, say, Nigeria, to feel accountable to Western donors, when we should be encouraging them to feel accountable to local people. We damage good governance when we don't sign up to transparency initiatives, so we refuse to let local people see how much their government is making from oil or other natural resources. And when we do deals on natural resources, which take resources away from local people, and there's a particularly horrific one where the EU purchased the fishing rights from Guinea-Bissau. So they paid a fraction of what they were really worth. But what's worse is the money went to the government and it took money away from local fishermen. So we need to think really carefully about aid and the way aid is given and the fact that not all aid is necessarily good aid from the point of view of good governance. When people are brave enough to challenge their oppressive governments, they put their lives at risk. And that's why one of the most important things that we can do is give sanctuary. And I want to tell you a story which I'm personally very upset about a young man who I'll call Joseph, again from the Democratic Republic of Congo. He'd been training to be a priest, so he was very well educated. And then he went and worked for one of the local chiefs. The army in the Congo started abducting 14-year-olds, boys to fight in the army and girls as prostitutes. And he wrote to complain on behalf of his community. The result was he was arrested, he was tortured, and he was sent to a prison from which people left only to be executed or else sent off to fight. Fortunately, one of the prison staff recognized Joseph from a family connection and smuggled him out of the Congo to the UK, where he sought asylum. Since then, most of the people arrested with him have been murdered, his uncle and his father in hiding. There have been three warrants for his arrest, which have been presented as evidence in his asylum claim to the Home Office. Despite all of this, the Home Office have told him that they don't think his human rights are at risk of being violated, and they're going to send him back to the Congo. I hope they won't, because I'm working with him, but anyway. I think we don't sufficiently understand the connection between violent conflict and asylum. We don't sufficiently understand that every time the UK gives asylum to someone who's been standing up to a government, it makes it easier for other people to stand up to governments. And when, as now, we're sending people back wholesale with no regard to whether they're going to be safe when they're sent back, then we send a very damaging message to people who've got the guts and the ability to stand up to governments. So I think sanctuary is really important. And the last thing I'm going to say is I'm going to talk a bit about weapons. I belong to a peace and security liaison group, and we constantly write to the government. And one of the things that we often say is, how can you present the UK as a force for good in the world when you're actively supporting, to the tune of nearly £1 billion a year, the second largest arms export industry in the world? And I think that, you know, I've suddenly made a connection between the fact that the conflicts are now almost entirely local and the arms trade. And the question in my mind is, if the conflicts are within countries, not between countries, who are the arms being used against? You know, the government isn't buying weapons to use against its neighbour. It's buying weapons to use against its own people, as we saw in East Timor, and as we're increasingly seeing in conflicts all over the world. And how can we really justify subsidising weapons manufacturers to sell weapons to governments who then use them against their own citizens? So this is a message we need to keep challenging the government on this. We need to get behind this sort of extraordinary line that we get back from them about they don't see any conflict at all between their policies on development and their policies supporting the arms industry. So that's all very big picture stuff, and sometimes and it's all important, and you know, I do urge you to all join the campaign against the arms trade and so forth. But sometimes we get overwhelmed and we think, well, what can we really do? And one of the reasons we set up Peace Direct was to offer people a bite-sized opportunity to feel that they were really making a difference in a particular conflict. So what we do in Peace Direct is we create a direct connection, that's why the name, between people here and particular peace-building groups in conflict areas. We do that through the Champions Program, which is a funding program, but we're also building link groups which support groups in conflict areas through solidarity and through building a relationship rather than through or as well as through money. And we've developed a sort of 10-step approach which groups can go through to prepare themselves to team up with a group overseas. And groups do different things. We have a group in North Oxfordshire supporting a project in Uganda, and they've done a lot of advocacy, writing to the UK government and saying, why are we supporting Museveni? He is prolonging the conflict. We should be putting pressure on him to bring the conflict to an end, which could be done. The group in Bristol have got a lot of publicity for Sami's work in the local newspaper, so that's good because it's showing people that there's another side to the story in Iraq. There's a group who have a very personal connection with the leader of Kapow in Afghanistan, and they do small things. They sort of collect toiletries and children's clothes and send them to Afghanistan, really as a sort of gesture of love and solidarity. So there are lots of different things that groups can do. Beyond that, there are a whole number of different ways that you can get involved in Peace Direct. One person bought 10 copies of this book for his book group, so he got his book group reading about conflict. And we've published on our web readers note, book group notes for 3 books in case people want to follow that path. If you sign up to our newsletter, every issue, there are a whole lot of things that you can do, because our strapline is everyone can do something about peace. Everyone can do something to support this amazing peace-building network that happens right across the world. We don't have to feel disempowered. We don't have to feel that it's just me against the global arms industry. We can feel that, you know, I and 50 other people can support the people in Mandera and make sure that their work is effective in building long-term peace. So I'm going to pause now and take questions. But when you go, I'd like you to please take a form of Fran and Tilly, who are standing there. Turn around, show their lovely... So these are our lovely Peace Direct T-shirts. If you see anyone walking around in one of these, stop them and ask a question. So what we've done is we're not asking you to sign up to give us £10 a month. That would be lovely. We're asking you to fill in a form and tell us about yourself, what sort of things you're interested in, what sort of things you might like to do, and bring it back to the stand sometime before the end of the event. And then we'll get in touch with you and say, well, we think, given what you've said, you might be interested in our training events, or you might be interested in going on our mailing list for jobs in the peace and security and development sector. So there are lots of different things, and we'll try and match them to what you're doing, to what you're interested in. Obviously, we also hope that you'll give us money, because we want to be a very big organisation in 20 years' time. We think that just as people give money to Amnesty and Oxfam, so in 20 years' time they'll be giving money to peace, not just through Peace Direct, but through other organisations, because without peace, there is no development and there are no human rights. So now I'm going to invite you to ask questions. Yes, you were first, or you first caught my eye.
Do you want this?
That's brilliant. Usually I have to ask the first question to get things going.
First of all, thanks very much for your comments and introducing the issues of peace. I just want to say in passing that, because peace is not an absence of conflict, and we welcome conflict in society, but we are really looking for non-violent ways of dealing with conflict, and
yes.
I think that's the backdrop
yes.
to this. You've talked about your ambitions for Peace Direct, but I just wanted to ask you about the funding policy for Peace Direct. You've suggested that you encourage small groups to get involved and make contributions. But one of the issues that came up when we were talking as a couple about the qualities of peacemakers was having a spirit of impartiality, which we know is very hard to actually... And I was thinking about the conditionality of aid, as you were saying, and the conditionality of funding that charities can get into. They get money from the US government, they get money from the corporates, from the multinationals, from even the UK government. And that can create tensions, and it can also compromise partners out there in conflicts that they might feel have been generated by the US government, for instance. And I wonder what Peace Direct's attitude and policy is on receiving funding, whether you have a direct, clear policy that you will not get funding from that government or that corporation, because it would compromise your very sensitive work at the grassroots?
I think that's a very good question. Our main approach is to raise money from the public, and that's for a couple of reasons. If we raise money from the public, we can give groups the kind of funding that they need. long-term funding or rapid response funding. If we raise money from government, we'll be giving groups the kind of money that government thinks they need. And that tends to be short-term, very hard to get hold of, very bureaucratic, with a lot of reporting. Obviously, accountability is important, but it needs to be a form of accountability that the people we're supporting feel is appropriate to the work that they're doing. Having said that, I don't have a policy that I'll never take money from governments, because in fact the project in Kirkuk is now being funded by the UNHCR because it was too big a project for us to be able to continue to fund. But in general, what we want to do is raise money from the public, partly because it's the right kind of funding and partly because that way we spread knowledge. You know, if we just got our money from governments or from 10 very rich people, then we wouldn't be spreading the understanding about conflict and violent conflict and how to deal with it, that I think is one of the really valuable aspects of a sort of funding relationship.
Carolyn, if I may just add to that. One thing that I've seen, or an aspect of that in relation to your question that I've seen that Peace Direct does, is how you can add value to the process as a mediator between grassroots and government so that you can ensure that actually the grassroots needs are being met and that there is a voice for the people at grassroots. So it can also be a very positive way. I wouldn't, as Carolyn said, I wouldn't just dismiss government money because it is sometimes you need that scale of funding. But it does give a voice to those, and you can make sure then that it's going in the right place and the right things are being done with it.
Yes, I think Inga's made a very important point because, of course, you know, part of what we're trying to do is increase the amount of government funding that goes into peacemaking rather than the use of force. But I think we need to take the time to persuade government of the right mechanisms for funding rather than just sort of use the mechanisms at the moment, which I don't think are the right ones. More questions?
Caroline, thanks for what you said. I was wondering, does Peace Direct ever see violence as a necessary means of securing peace? And I'm thinking, the sort of premise of my question is from gospel stories like the cleansing of the temple and the fact that crucifixion and the means God secured peace between man and humanity was in itself a very violent act.
We are essentially a very practical organisation, so I think it's fair to say there isn't a Peace Direct view on that, but we only support people who are committed to nonviolence, partly because we think that's the right thing to do, and partly because that's what our charitable objects enable us to do. So you wouldn't find us supporting any group that were making use of violent means, but I'm not going to say that everyone in Peace Direct is completely pacifist or that all our supporters are. So I've kind of sidestepped your question, but that's because we are really not an organisation about sort of theory and research. We're an organisation about practical action. More questions? Well, I'll just... Oh, please.
It's just a question, really, whether you'd be able to tell us a little bit more about how you actually got involved working for Peace Direct. I was quite interested to read that previously you've worked in the civil service and now have ended up doing this.
Yes.
I'm currently a civil servant and
thinking
about whether I should be doing what I'm doing. Also, work for the Home Office as well. So
kind interesting.
Have been involved in asylum and all sorts of claims. But yeah, just be interesting to hear a little bit about how you got to where you are.
Okay.
And perhaps any sort of insights for people thinking that they want to become more involved in doing conflict resolution, but kind of practical steps people might want to
right.
take.
Okay, well, my career is a long and winding road. I started in DFID when it was then the Ministry of Overseas Development, but I realised after about 2.5 years that it wasn't the right organisation for me. It was too big. I think I'm really a small organisation person. So then I worked in the Cabinet Office in the think tank, which was brilliant. Then I decided that was the most fun I'd ever have in the civil service, so I left the civil service. And eventually, by a completely random chain of events, I became a venture capitalist. So I was investing in technology startups. And one of my colleagues, Mohammed, often describes Peace Direct as venture capitalist for peace, because what we're doing is very similar. We're trying to find people with real talent and potential and make a long-term investment in them. I got interested in Peace Direct in 2002 when I was sitting in a giving circle in the Network for Social Change, and we made 8 grants to peace organizations, and they were all based in London. And I suddenly thought, hang on, wouldn't it be great if we could create a trusted channel to move resources from here into the conflict areas and support the work that local people are doing, which didn't really seem to exist. So I went out and looked for someone else with the same idea, and I found Scylla Elworthy, who'd already published this book at the Oxford Research Group, which is really brilliant and is sort of the Bible of this kind of work. And together we kind of worked and tried and struggled, and we got Peace Direct off the ground. In terms of people thinking of getting into this kind of work, I think there are lots of opportunities in the UK. One of the things that we're planning to do in a couple of years' time is something called the Peace Direct Challenge, where we'd be taking all the know-how from conflict areas and challenging people to use the same skills and techniques to deal with conflict in the UK. We run some workshops, so if you're interested in being put on the mailing list, that gives a sort of opportunity to try out conflict resolution techniques, or you could look at training through Mediation UK as a community mediator. So there are ways into work both in the UK and in overseas, although getting into overseas conflict resolution work is quite difficult because there are lots and lots of people being trained and not that many organisations, but we hope that will change. And keep up the struggle within the Home Office. I know it's really difficult. I once talked to someone who said, you have to understand that immigration officers are the only people that everyone feels entitled to lie to. And that sort of explains a rather kind of jaded approach. But so do we have time for one more question? Okay, well, if there isn't another question, then I'll say thank you very much to all of you for coming. Please go and tell everyone you're here with to come and visit our stand. They can draw a symbol or take away a newsletter or just find out more about what we're doing. And maybe I'll see some of you again here next year.